You're tuned in to the Kojo Nam, the show on WAMU 88.5. Welcome. Later in the broadcast, we'll talk about changes to the district's 311 and 911 programs. But first, in Maryland and across the country, sexual assault survivors and their advocates are claiming that law enforcement agencies aren't handling sexual assault cases with the best interest of survivors at heart. In some cases, police are encouraging survivors to waive their right to an investigation. In others, rape kits are sitting on police department shelves for years, untested. Legislators and advocates in Maryland are pushing to change that. Joining us by phone is Mark Greenblatt. He's a senior national investigative correspondent with Newsy. Mark Greenblatt, thank you for joining us.
Good to be with you.
Mark, you wrote about the practice of extraordinary clearance as part of a joint investigation with Reveal, Newsy, and ProPublica called Case Cleared, How Rape Goes Unpunished in America. What's extraordinary clearance, and how is it used by police departments to clear rape cases?
Well, what our study found, a really first-of-its-kind approach to studying law enforcement agencies across the country, is that far too many are claiming success publicly, claiming that they've solved rape cases by clearing them. Effectively, in the police agency's speaking terms, that is how they talk about how successful they are at solving cases. But what we found as we unpacked those cleared cases, and we found they use this term called exceptional clearance, which the FBI has intended to be used in only very rare circumstances, such as when police really have solved a case, they have probable cause to make an arrest, but perhaps the suspect is dead and he's not arrestable. There's some other loopholes that they can fall in here. But what we really did find is that many police agencies are really abusing this tactic. They do not always have to tell the FBI how often they're using it. They just report the aggregate number of cleared cases, and they make it sound like they're clearing a lot of rapes, when in fact they're really oftentimes leaving suspects on the streets, closing cases with no justice, and very sadly, some of these people that we tracked that are left on the streets go on to strike again.
How widespread is the process of exceptional clearance around the country?
You know, it's very disparate depending on what agency you look at. You can look at one police agency that tells you that they clear a certain number of cases, and they're really largely telling the truth and providing an accurate picture for the public. But then there are cases, for instance, in Montgomery County, Maryland, where they tell the public that they have a clearance rate of 83% for the crime of rape in a recent year. When we unpacked it through FOIA requests and data requests, we found that they were actually exceptionally clearing 61% of the cases, meaning only 22%, in fact, were arrested. But they claim publicly to be clearing almost four times that amount. And so you can see the difference in the messages that the public hears versus how many people are really actually being taken off the streets.
What's wrong with this practice? There seems to be a consensus between sexual assault survivors, advocacy groups, and the International Association of Chiefs of Police that this is not within best practices for responding to sexual assaults.
Well, it's allowed, again, in these rare circumstances, but when police agencies are telling a survivor that, we can't arrest or prosecute the person who has done this thing to you, but we believe we have probable cause to make the arrest. That's one of the requirements to be able to claim a case is solved by exceptional clearance. You actually have to have probable cause. So what they're effectively saying to survivors is, look, we have probable cause to make an arrest here. We're just not going to do it for one of several reasons. In cities like Austin, Texas, we found more than 1,000 cases like this that were happening there over several years. Police really telling their community, we believe we have probable cause to arrest more than 1,000 rapists, but we aren't doing it. And so that's the rub here. It's a public safety issue or a communications issue with telling the truth to the public about how many cases they're actually solving.
Joining us now also from studios of the Baltimore Sun is Catherine Wrench. She's an investigative reporter with the Baltimore Sun. Catherine, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Kojo. Hey, Mark.
You did an investigation for the Sun about how this practice has been used in this region. What did you learn about how rape cases are investigated around here?
Well, very similar to what Mark was talking about, we found that a couple of agencies, including Baltimore County and Montgomery County, were they had exceptionally high rates of clearance, which, you know, on the police balance sheet, so to say, makes it look like they're doing a very good job of arresting perpetrators. However, what we found is that actually a high percentage of that is coming from these exceptionally cleared cases. So thanks to Mark's work and those at ProPublica, they had really pulled apart the data to show that in Baltimore County, for example, they had a 68% clearance rate. Well, about half of that was actually due to these exceptionally cleared cases. And it was even higher in Montgomery County. So of the 331 rape cases reported in 2016, about 83% were cleared, but, you know, a very small percentage, just 26% were actually cleared by arrest. The rest was from these exceptionally cleared cases.
And you report that police departments in the Baltimore area prompted sexual assault victims to waive their rights to an investigation 223 times, according to a survey by the Baltimore Sun. But why would someone choose not to have police investigate a sexual assault that they survived?
All right. So we found out about these waivers that the International Association of Police Chiefs recommends against using. But when they initially recommended against using them back in 2005, and one of the waivers that one of the consultants who actually wrote the police chief's recommendation, she uses this waiver as an example, comes from Baltimore County, and So victims signed that we dug into a few cases here in Baltimore County, which had a very high number of these waivers. There were 172 over the last couple of years. And so that was about a quarter of the rapes reported to the county. And so, what we understand from police is that they were given them these forms after they said that they did not want to report, they didn't want to participate in an investigation, and so they signed these forms. Now, what was interesting is that in Baltimore County, they didn't do this with any other kind of crime, only with sexual assault survivors. And so the implication from women's rights advocates we spoke to is that they're doing this in a way to kind of get rid of the case so they can exceptionally clear it or clear it off of their desk, essentially. These are sometimes complicated cases involving alcohol and involving acquaintances. Sometimes it can be a he said, she said, but some of the cases we looked at really, one might think that they could go to court. Some of them were very much like the Brock Turner case, for example, in Stanford, where you have women who are incapacitated or who appear to be incapacitated. And what's more is what was concerning to a lot of experts we spoke to is that some of these forms about not prosecuting were signed while, you know, they were at the hospital, while the victims were at the hospital, either before.
So
or
that in these
after.
Cases, the victim was in a traumatic state and apparently, according to the police, chose not to have an investigation at that point. But during the time of that traumatic state, the victim's decision-making ability might have been significantly impaired. I want to bring in Sarah Elfrath to the conversation. She's a Democratic state senator representing District 30, which is Anne Arundel County in the Maryland State Senate. Senator Elfrath, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You reached out to the office of Anne Arundel County Executive Stuart Pittman after reading this piece. What did you hear from him about this practice?
Well, first I want to thank Catherine and Mark for bringing this to our attention. I reached out to our county executive within about 20 minutes of reading the article to make sure that he knew, was aware of this, because I was not. And within another 40 minutes, he made the decision, and our county police department made the decision to stop this practice. And Shelley Haldeman, a delegate from Baltimore County, did the same thing with her county executive, Johnny Oshevsky. And again, the Baltimore County executive did the right thing in a timely manner. So I just want to thank everybody involved for bringing this to our attention, and we were able to resolve it in a quick time period.
Well, Mark, Greenback, Montgomery, Prince George's, Howard County have a policy not to give waivers to sexual assault survivors, but despite Prince George's County having that policy, they did have 8 of the forms filled out over the past 2 years. They said that the forms were filled out erroneously, meaning they were intended for other types of crimes, which we heard Catherine talk about. How common are waivers for other types of crimes?
So they're not common from what we looked at, but I want to underscore the importance of this. You know, we looked deep into Baltimore County's files and really reviewed probably 180 or close to 200 exceptionally cleared cases. And so many of these cases in Baltimore County, for instance, really were being cleared because the police officers, the detectives and the sex crimes units were going to victims and saying, sign this form. And we saw cases where in their files where there was a survivor who was telling an initial responding officer, I want to report a rape. They say, well, do you want to take a rape test kit? Sure, they say. They go to the hospital. They prepare themselves to take a very invasive, very traumatic physical experience in order to try to bring justice. And in these moments, we saw time and again where there were actually detectives from their sex crimes unit that would, in fact, go to the bedside right there, right where they're preparing to take a rape test kit and have some kind of conversation that's not documented that ends up leading to the person saying, okay, I don't want to take the test kit anymore, and I'm going to sign this form, and that's going to be the end of my case. And so there's something that was happening there that went from a victim wanting to report a rape to police to all of a sudden, after a conversation with police, no longer wanting to participate in the process. And this was all happening, as you point out, right in a moment of high trauma. And what the International Association of Chiefs of Police is really worried about here is not putting pressure on people during moments of high trauma, letting them breathe for a little while and sort of investigating in a manner that sets up a way that's comfortable for people to tell the truth and not feel pressured. And so the actions of the local lawmaker here who's joining us on the show and the local county leaders who are responding quickly, you know, this is not just about paperwork here. This is about real people and how real victims, are afforded the chance to get justice.
Joining us now by phone is Lise Jordan, Executive Director and Counsel for the Maryland Coalition Against Sexual Assault. Lise Jordan, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We've just heard the kind of examples that Mark Greenblatt and Catherine Rentz have been reporting about people signing these waivers hours after a sexual assault. Two questions. One, is that alarming to you? And two, why do you think police urge people to do this?
Kojo, it's absolutely outrageous. And I think that one of the reasons it's so outrageous is because this is nothing new. This is a policy that's been in place since 2005. Across the country, we recognize that waivers are completely, totally inappropriate in sexual assault cases. These are women and men who have just experienced great trauma. They are now being asked to have an extremely invasive, very long, very detailed, very difficult examination. And then to say, oh, you don't want to continue with the exam, or you don't want to answer my questions right now, or you don't want to continue with this process right this second, here, sign this form, and we'll stop everything. It's absolutely outrageous, and it really speaks volumes about the suspicion that people have about rape survivors, the worry that people have that they're going to be perceived as not being responsive, and the unwillingness to really address the issue. I think what's so frustrating is that, you know, I had the same conversation 10 years ago and the same conversation 10 years before that. Now, I respect Johnny Olszewski for sure. I knew him as a legislator. I think he and his staff are sincere, but they are saying the same thing that his predecessor said. And we have heard this over and over again, and we really need to do a better job at increasing transparency and developing trust between law enforcement and rape survivors. Otherwise, 10 years from now, we're going to have exactly the same conversation over again.
Got to take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue this conversation, encouraging you to join it. I'm Kojo Nam.
Hi, it's Diane. The next meeting of my book club is on Wednesday, May 31st at 1 p.m. Eastern. I'll host a discussion of Mad Honey by Jodi Picco and Jennifer Finney Boylan, followed by a conversation with the authors. Find out more and register at dianereem.org/bookclub.
Welcome back. We're talking about efforts to change local sexual assault investigations with Catherine Rents, investigative reporter with the Baltimore Sun, Mark Greenblatt, senior national investigative correspondent with Newsy, Lisa Jordan is executive director and counsel for the Maryland Coalition Against Sexual Assault, and Sarah Elfrath is a Democratic state senator representing District 30, Anne Arundel County, in the Maryland State Senate. Onto the phones, here is Nick in Winchester, Virginia. Nick, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Kojo, I'm a male, obviously, I hope, about your age. And I just want to have one ancillary comment. We talk about people drinking, and we assume that they are adults. If they are drinking and the woman's judgment is impaired, it might be reasonable to conclude that the man's a judgment has been equally impaired. Not necessarily equally, but has also been impaired. And that's all I think I wanted to say at this point.
Well, you seem to be suggesting, and since you seem to know my age, then I will infer from your comments that you are a senior citizen, and that you seem to be suggesting that if both individuals are impaired, then there's really no one at fault here.
I'm simply saying that they both have responsibility for their actions.
Well, allow me to have Lisa Jordan respond to that. Lisa Jordan?
Well, alcohol is not an excuse for rape. And I think that when we think of other crimes, we never permit alcohol to be an excuse for the crime. And certainly it's true that alcohol is involved sometimes in sexual violence, that we see that and it can make it more difficult to prosecute a case. But it doesn't make it impossible, and our laws don't allow people to have sex with people who are unable to consent. So I appreciate the question. We need to acknowledge that alcohol is involved in these cases, and it can be important for juries to hear information about the role of alcohol in sexual violence, but it's not an excuse.
Catherine Rents, if someone signs one of these waivers, is there any way for that person to reverse that decision if that person changes their mind?
Absolutely, there is, and everybody listening should know that. In fact, many of these cases, the women did as early as a day after. I mean, some of the women were, quite frankly, one of them was legally drunk when she signed this form, and she, is now suing the department. But many women have reversed course, and once they go through the thought process of what happened and then later decide to reopen. A lot of them has. And some of, like Anne Arundel County made clear on its waiver form that their case can be reopened. And Baltimore County eventually did. Its waiver form for many years did not have that option, but in 2016, it said, you can reopen it, but at the same time, it also said, by the way, your evidence is going to be destroyed within a year, which was its policy then, which has since changed in part because of legislation that Lisa and others have pushed through the state legislature to keep rape kits, to keep evidence around for another 20 years.
We're going to get to that rape kit issue in just a second, but first I wanted Bruce in Washington, D.C. You're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, thank you very much for taking my call. I mean, I'm sitting here listening, and I'm really pretty incredulous. I mean, it seems to me we shouldn't need a policy to tell officers that convincing women in this state of distress that they should drop their investigations. It seems like the officers have so thoroughly violated their duty to serve and protect. They should be fired for, you know, both gross and grotesque violation of their duty. And Senator Elfbreth said she read about this, and within 20 minutes she took action. Within 40 minutes, the policy was stopped. That's great. I mean, it's definitely the least we should do. But what's being done to investigate what the reporters found? These people should be fired.
Senator Elfrith.
Thank you. And thank you for your question. I think it's also important to note that no other crime, to my knowledge, is only reported at 20% of when it's committed. And it's so important that we build trusting relationships between the police, who are here to do the right thing, and victims of these cases. And at the same time, making sure that victims feel as respected and supported as possible. So I have not had conversations with our county executive or the Baltimore County executive about investigating these further, but it's a great recommendation, and I'll move forward on it. Thank you.
You've also been working on passing a rape kit reform package. What would that legislation do if it passes?
There's a couple of bills that go into that. And again, Delegate Shelley Hedelman from Baltimore County has led the way along with Lisa on this issue for the last few years. I have been on the job for about 40 days now in the Senate, so I want to make sure Shelley gets credit for all her work. She's working on a couple of bills. One bill that we're working on together, she has the bill in the House of Delegates. I'm sponsoring it in the Senate, would provide a fund to match local jurisdictions, municipalities, and counties to test backlogs of rape kits. The federal government provides grant funding. We wanted to say at the state level, and we haven't designated a number yet, but we wanted to be as supportive as possible to help our local jurisdictions tackle these backlogs and really face this issue head on.
Lisa Jordan, what exactly is a rape kit, and how are they used in sexual assault investigations?
Rape kits are they're a system of collecting forensic evidence. So that's evidence that you're going to use in court. And they are head-to-toe. So head-to-toe, a nurse talks to a rape survivor about what happened. They find out where she or he was touched, where there might have been exchange of bodily fluids, what sort of actions happened. And then they go from the very tip of your head and they collect evidence from every single part, including internally, to see if we can find DNA evidence, to look for evidence of abrasions, to look for evidence of other injuries, look for anything that corroborates what happened. They are long, they are involved, and for many survivors, they are really a source of re-traumatization. So as community members, we have to do everything we possibly can to support and lift up these brave women and men who agree to go through a rape exam. It's not something they're benefiting from personally. Yes, there can be great satisfaction in bringing a rapist to justice, but this is something they're doing to help protect the whole community from a sex offender. So they're very difficult, and we need to be very careful with that evidence so we can use it in court.
Rebecca writes on our Facebook page, if you read what a woman has to endure to get these kits done in the first place, you'd be 10 times as disgusted that they are sitting untested. Senator Elfrith, why is there such a backlog of untested rape kits in Maryland?
Thank you for your question. I got this when I was on the walking onto the floor of the Senate last week as well. You know, and I'm not going to talk about why I think for decades we've had this backlog. It's clear that we have not had enough women in elected office, enough women in police or state's attorney's offices. right now, I can tell you we have more elected women in the Maryland General Assembly than ever in our history, and we're working together to tackle this from all sides and all angles and making sure we're funding this as well. We're not passing on unfunded mandates to our municipalities and counties. We're working hand-in-hand with them, as we saw yesterday, thanks to the Baltimore Sun reporting, that we're trying to be solution-oriented as we move forward.
Lisa Jordan, what are reasons that a police department would not run a test on a rape kit?
Well, one of the reasons we've heard is money. They say that they don't have enough funding to go forward. Another reason is that they sometimes are looking at cases just at an individual basis. They say, all right, in this particular case, we already know the identity of the rapist, and the only issue is consent. But in other jurisdictions where they've tested all of the rape kits, one of the things that we've learned is that many rapists rape a lot of people. So this idea that rape is a he said, she said is really not typical. It's often he said, they said. And if we don't test those kits, we're not going to be able to connect the dots between the different cases. And that's one of the reasons it's so important that we always test these rape kits.
Mark,
money is not a good excuse.
Mark Greenblatt, is this lack of testing of rape kits consistent with trends in the rest of the country?
Yeah, I think it is an issue that's affecting a lot of police departments around the country. But I really want to underscore something that Ms. Jordan just said there. You know, we spoke to some of the senior most criminologists that study this sort of thing around the nation for our report. And one of the things that really, really surprised me was that what they said consistently, you know, there's this myth almost out there that rapes, you know, that should be prosecuted are the ones that are the stranger rapes, where you're walking down the street at night and someone nabs you and rapes you, and those certainly need to be prosecuted. But what we've seen happening in far too many places is prosecutors' offices that take this sort of rape that is actually far more prevalent, the kind where you know your attacker. It might be someone you're dating, it might be someone that you work with, and those are the ones that become these proverbial he said, she said cases, but they happen far more often than the stranger rapes. And the thing that really struck me about these is that criminologists who've studied it say that those who have raped someone that they know, a non-stranger rape, actually are oftentimes of a predilection to do it again. And so the importance of testing these kits, the importance of really prosecuting cases that where you do have some evidence and sworn statements to move forward on, and perhaps obtaining this evidence from the head-to-toe examination that you've heard talked about here, it really is important, not just for the one rape victim, but also for those that criminologists will say are likely to become victims in the future.
Catherine Rentz, we got an email from David. Does the research say anything about how a report by a victim ever gets on the books in the first place? For example, any evidence that police downgrade the offense to a different offense or not record it at all if the victim doesn't want to prosecute, do a rape exam, or testify against the offender?
Well, in a lot of these cases, I found that they were classified as unfounded or exceptionally cleared. And so, there are a lot of them that end up on the police balance sheet, so to say. But at the same time, a lot of them, as I understand, there's another category called a suspicious circumstance, and those do not get on the police balance sheet. That's something I'm looking into right now. But as Mark was talking about before, when you exceptionally clear something, that is a way to improve your clearance rate. It looks like you cleared it. Some people might think it was cleared by arrest. However, in reality, it has not been.
Here now is Neil in Gaithersburg, Maryland. Neil, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Good afternoon, or is it good morning still?
It's afternoon.
No, it is afternoon. So I have two questions. I'll ask the first, hear the answer, and then if you will allow me the time, I have a second question. This conversation started in an aspect of exceptional clearance rates and such, and it's kind of gone more broadly into sexual abuse case issues. And I wanted to bring it back and just ask a statistical question. I read a long newspaper article on this same issue of very high exceptional clearance rates in a few police departments associated with sexual abuse or rape or whatever similar cases. And the thing that I wondered then and still wonder now is, are those rates of exceptional clearance that, and clearly that one would suppose that in some cases, at least, they're in order to improve the balance sheet, as one of your guests just said, are those really relegated to just these types of sexual assault cases or murder, arson, you know, a lot of other very serious crimes? Are there similar pushes to push a lot of them into the exceptional clearance, again, in order
Mark
to make
Greenblatt?
The balance sheets look better?
Great, great question. Smart question. You know, we did look at other crimes, and what we saw was that, sure, exceptional clearances are allowed by the FBI as part of the Uniform Crime Report for any kind of crime that's required to be reported under their rules. But we saw again and again that police departments had a higher percentage of doing this and using this type of clearance for sexual assault cases, for rape cases in particular, is how they're reported as on the violent crime balance sheet. And let me just underscore something that's Maryland-specific here, going back to Baltimore County, one of the key cases that we profiled in our report to let you understand, you know, really, really the challenges here. There was a case of a young girl who was being investigated by the Baltimore County Police Department for she wasn't being investigated. She was a victim, rather, of someone who's now an alleged child sex predator who had driven from far north in the country in Michigan to have sex with this young girl. This young girl told a police agency in Maryland about it. There was motel receipts. There were emails. There were text messages that were part of the file that eventually landed at the Baltimore County Police Department's hands. And they ended up closing this case exceptionally without ever having a conversation with the suspect because the young girl grew uncomfortable working with the sex crimes detectives, and she stopped cooperating at one point. And what ends up happening is this this suspect, without ever being investigated, is left on the streets, and he was later arrested in Wisconsin for having sex with another underage girl. They found child porn on his phone at the time, and you know, he and the detective there told me that they also found evidence that he had had contact with yet another underage girl in Ohio. So essentially, you know, it appears as if they had exceptionally cleared this case, claimed credit, you know, bumped up their clearance rate, made themselves look better while leaving this guy on the streets who went on to prey again. And so there really are some high stakes here while when it's being used, you know, there are some high stakes and some people that really could pay the price.
We're almost out of time, but Senator Elfrith, last year Maryland was awarded $2.6 million in grant funds to test rape kits and hire victim advocates. Has the state made progress in dealing with rape cases since the grant?
I can't speak to that. That's a better question for Lisa. I can tell you I'm about to walk into the committee hearing on a bill we have to do that same thing, but on college campuses, which we all know is a huge challenge as well, is to provide modest attorney's fees for victims of rape and sexual assault on college campuses. So we are tackling this from as many angles as we can think of within this 90-day session, and I promise you we're going to look at it, continue to look at it over the interim and come back next January with more solutions.
Lisa Jordan, any progress in dealing with rape cases since that grant?
Well, Kojo, although we did hear that we got the grant in September, unfortunately the federal shutdown and other issues of the Department of Justice delayed things. So we are just now beginning to plan for the grant and hopefully are going to be able to start on March 1st.
Okay.
That will be for old kits only, but we are very pleased to have victim advocates who can support survivors through that. It's good going backwards, but I completely agree with Senator Elfrith. We have a lot of work to do going forward, and so everything from preventing HIV for rape victims to protecting their privacy to having mandatory testing of rape kits, all of those things are in front of the General Assembly this year, and we really need to pass all of those bills to make good progress.
I'll have Charnel Covert in Maryland have the last word. Charnel Covert is a Force community organizer and collective member. Charnel Covert, you only have about a minute left, but go ahead, please.
Hi, thank you for having me. I just wanted to say I'm so grateful for the work that you all are doing on this, and I wanted to
raise the issue of intersectionality when thinking about this topic. We've been doing a lot of community building work in Baltimore City around getting the support from victim survivors and hearing what they have to say. And one of the things that came up in a community forum that we had regarding feelings about the Baltimore Police Department is that there is not good and consistent training on ways to interact with victim survivors of sexual assault. And in particular, when we think about sexual assault, especially as it relates to women of color, people of color, and gender nonconforming folks of color, that venom is very much there. And so we definitely need to think about these institutional structures that inform the way that police officers and the way that legislators think about how victim survivors are treated.
Thank you very much for your call, Chanel Covert. And thank you all for joining us, Catherine Rentz, Mark Greenblatt, Lisa Jordan, and Sarah Elford. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you.
Got to take a short break. When we come back, we'll talk about changes to the district's 311 and 911 programs. I'm Kojo Nam.
WAMU 88.5 is your listener-supported NPR news station in the greater Washington, D.C. region. You can support the Kojo Namdi Show and all the regional coverage you value by becoming a member today. Click the donate button at WAMU.org, and thanks.